So our reading this morning is from Matthew chapter 5, verses 1 to 12, which includes the Sermon on the Mount and the Beatitudes. Seeing the crowds, he went up on the mountain, and when he sat down, his disciples came to him. And he opened his mouth, and he taught them, saying, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be satisfied. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall receive mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God. Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when others revile you and persecute you and utter all kinds of evil against you falsely on my account. Rejoice and be glad, for your reward is great in heaven, for so they persecuted the prophets who were before you."
My name is Scott. I'm the lead pastor here. And just want to underline what Christy said. We actually had a bunch of organizations, including the town, reach out to us with the SNAP benefits going away for who knows how long. They need us to, like, show up. They need us to step up. It's just one of those moments where we have an opportunity to show people that that we care and that this matters to us. And the more proximate you are to those who are losing these, the more you feel the desperation of that. And we want to be that as a community. And so this is not like just one food drive among many. This is a pretty urgent thing. And I would just say, please, please, please do an extra, double your grocery shopping this week. There's no reason not to, and bring that back so that we can be a blessing. Fair? Is that cool? That's not like a guilting thing. That's just like, this is when the church gets to step up. So let's do that happily and joyfully, even in light of everything that we've been talking about in the Sermon on the Mount. And so with that, before we get into today's teaching, why don't you turn to someone and tell them how you ended up here, introduce yourself. We'll just do this for 2 or 3 minutes. Ready? Go. All right, everybody. Let's bring it in. All right. Everybody have seats? You guys good? Yeah, there's seats up front. There's seats over there. There's two next to Andrea. Two up here. They're all up here, gang. Sorry. I don't watch many cop shows. I'm not a big cop detective type, but I was watching one of them this week, and there was a scene where a guy who was actually working for the criminals interacts with the guy who sort of convinced him to do this, who was another cop. And I'm not telling you the show because I fear your judgment. And the guy walks in and he says, how do you do this? I've only been doing this for 2 years working for the other side, and I feel like I've aged 20. I don't sleep. I don't eat. And the guy says to him, you get used to it. You find ways to rationalize it. Hey, I put my three boys through college. And that's where the interaction ends. I just thought it was such an interesting image of what Jesus seems to be getting at in the beatitude that we're talking about today. Today we're talking about, blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. And my sort of hot take would be that what the younger cop, the one who was struggling with it, was trying to maintain was what I think Jesus here is calling a kind of purity of heart. We've been in this long enough now, these Beatitudes, that hopefully you're getting a feel for them. You're kind of maybe remembering the things that they aren't. These aren't direct commands. These aren't just future blessings we're talking about. What they are is that they're more sort of consolation for those who find themselves in these places, especially the first bunch. Blessed are the poor in spirit. Blessed are those who mourn. That Jesus is literally comforting people who he's talking to. But then also he's preparing those same people to participate in the kingdom whose coming he is announcing. And what he's telling us up front is, look, this will cost you something to participate with what I am doing. And Jesus, ever the gracious, good, wise, righteous shepherd that he is, doesn't want to sell us a bill of goods at the beginning and say, blessed are, and then he tells us all of the wonderful things that we already want to be. Instead, he says, no, blessed are those who find themselves in positions where life gets hard precisely because faithfulness in this world is hard. And Jesus says, that is where, strangely, you will experience the depth of my presence, that you will be keenly aware that I am with you. And he says, so that is true blessing in this life. And so blessing always isn't necessarily about circumstantial thriving, Jesus is telling us, but instead, sometimes, by definition, my way will lead you to places where the world would say that you want to avoid because blessing couldn't possibly show up in those circumstances. Jesus says, no, no, no. If you're being faithful to me and find yourself there, believe me, there will be, there I will be. I will be with you in that place. And that is the blessing for which we long. This beatitude is really no different. And we're going to jump right into it. So here it is. It's, blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Here's the structure this morning. We're going to talk about what it means to see God, what it means to be pure in heart, and how we pursue that. Okay, very simple this morning. I'm going to start at the end, because all good calls to a certain kind of life begin with a vision of what that life might provide for us. We need the end goal in mind. If you're going to start training, you've got to have something in mind. If you start training for a marathon, you've got to have that vision in mind of what would it be like to cross that line and have that medal. And, stick that sticker on the back of my car so that the whole world knows that this one time, 26.24, whatever it is, 26.2, right? Some of those of you who read, you were like, it's two. I get it. Okay. Right. You got to have a vision of, why would I begin pursuing this thing to start with? What makes it compelling? I was just with our leader cohort, some of our folks who are in our leadership development stuff, and I was telling them my favorite example of beginning at the end is, of all things, forgive me for this, but it's a football analogy, but Nick Saban, who is considered the greatest college football coach ever, there's a story that his players tell that they're in the weight room. This is way before the season starts. This is like the spring before the season is even going to get started. And he walks into the weight room, the whole place goes quiet. And he stands in front of those young men and he says, young men, today a journey begins, a journey unlike any other, journey that ends with something that you will never forget. And they think he's going to say a national championship or, you know, an undefeated record. And he says, there is something that happens in this program that doesn't happen in any program, which is about the third quarter, about halfway through the third quarter here in Alabama, that's the team that I coach, we never win in the first half. Instead, about halfway through the third quarter, there's this moment that happens. Anyone who's played here will tell you it happens, where we are so physically superior to the other team that you will line across from another young man who has given his life to the sport, and you will see you have defeated him, and that he wants nothing more than to go home because he's given everything he has. He has nothing left, and he can tell you've got everything left. He walks out of the gym. You see what he's doing there? He's giving them a vision of something that will compel their hearts to say, I want that. And whatever it takes, I will do to accomplish, to achieve, to actually experience what's just been laid out in front of me. And that's what I love about Nick Saban. But what I love even more about Jesus is he's a master at this. And that's part of what he's doing in all of these Beatitudes. He's giving us a vision. He's opening our eyes to say, I and I alone provide for you what you most desperately long for, which whether you realize it or not, the thing for which your soul, I don't care who you are, I don't care what your beliefs are when you walked in here, but what your soul most longs for is to be face to face with your Creator, to see Him. And it's not just about that act of sight, it's to see Him face to face in the intimacy of relationship for which you were made. You see, the great tragedy, everything that's wrong with your life, everything, all of the nonsense going on in this world, all of the sin, all of the injustice, is the result of the fact that we as human beings made a choice that caused us to be sent from the presence of God. In fact, graciously guarded from the presence of God, because in our broken, corrupt, rebellious state, who God was simply too much for us to bear in our rebellion. So we're sent away from His presence. And ever since then, we have been, so to speak, longing for Eden. And not just for a physical place, but longing for the one who is physically present in that place, longing to know God face to face. And yet the devastating witness of the scriptures is that human beings can no longer do this. So it makes this beatitude so interesting. It's one among many, and so we can miss it. We just sort of breeze by it. Yeah, theirs is the kingdom. They will be comforted. They'll receive mercy. Sure, we'll see the face of God. We should go, record scratch. What? We will see God? When the scriptures say things, when Moses is having his interaction with the actual presence of God, God himself says, but you cannot see my face, for man cannot see my face and live. It's in Exodus 33:20. Even this isn't just an Old Testament reality. John chapter 1, we looked at this in depth at one point as a church. John chapter 1, 18, no one has ever seen God. But then this, here's where it gets interesting. But the only God who is at the Father's side, that's talking about Jesus, has made Him known. Interesting, just hold on to that. 1 Timothy 6, I only tell you that to say this is New Testament. He who is the blessed and only sovereign, the King of kings and the Lord of lords, who alone has immortality. Yeah, that sounds a lot like God. Who dwells in unapproachable light, whom no one has ever seen or can see. Other side of Jesus, still, no one can see God. To Him be honor and eternal dominion. Amen. 1 John, same author, 4:12. No one has ever seen God. You getting the point yet? And yet, if we love one another, God abides in us and His love is perfected in us. So there's this very interesting biblical tension. Then we have this. Here's the promise of what's to come. 1 John 3:2, that same author. Beloved, we are God's children now. And what we will be has not yet appeared. Men who are on men's retreat, this should ring a bell. But we know that when he appears, we shall be like him because we shall see him as he is. Revelation 22:4. Those who are redeemed, those who are in the presence of God, will see his face and his name will be on their foreheads. So an interesting tension. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Well, you can't see God. Right? What's this getting at? I think that we have to name this tension, which is, yes, in one sense, this is, in eternity, sort of the highest good that we will receive. Of all of the amazing things about that day, when the four corners of the earth are transformed, when your physical body is transformed, when there will be no sin or death or mourning or pain or any of that stuff, anymore, as wonderful as all of that will be, the single greatest thing about that will be at last our opportunity, and I think we can say our ability to see God face to face. And yet, there's something about God that we have begun to experience. I don't know if you heard it in those passages, but first we've seen him in Jesus. Right? No one's ever seen God, but the only God, the Son, who's at the right hand of the Father, has made him known. This is why Jesus, when his disciples constantly, how many times did we look at this, if you're around for our time in the Gospel of John, say, Jesus, you're great, you're amazing, you are just a spectacular teacher and miracle worker, and we're trying to wrap our heads around this Trinity thing, but like, can we see God? Can you some of them, even just for a second, like, can we talk to your dad? And you remember what Jesus says again and again? If you have seen me, what? You have seen the Father, right? It's a very interesting thing. And yet, what we get is this sense that in some way, Jesus and the fullness of who God is still, and here I'm going to lean into a deeply theological lyric that you've all probably sung at some point. Remember this lyric? Veiled in flesh, the Godhead see. Hail the incarnate deity. That is a deeply theological statement. Because Jesus is fully God, fully embodying who God is, and yet, in a sense, is veiled in his incarnation, such that we see God, but not yet quite as fully, which has nothing to do, hear me now, which has nothing to do with Jesus. It actually has everything to do with us. That we are the ones who lack the ability to see God. C.S. Lewis, who I often quote up here, great author of last century, wrote the Chronicles of Narnia. His most difficult work of fiction is called, does anybody know? It's called Till We Have Faces. So not to ruin that book for you, but do you know why it's called Till We Have Faces? Is because it's saying that humanity's lack of encounter with God is because we lack the face, we lack the ability to actually see God. And so it's talking about the longing that we have, that actually the problem with the apparent hiddenness of God is actually a problem that exists entirely on the human side of things. Isn't that wild? Right? Like if you've ever wondered, the giant elephant in the room of Christian faith, right? Like maybe you're someone here and you're skeptical or you don't know where you're at with faith. The thing that might seem so obvious to you that we as Christians don't often just name is like, okay, like where is he? Right? Like why can't I see God? Wouldn't the easiest way to convert people be if God just, what's up, Rutgers, right? And then like just, you know, every Rutgers student falls to their knees and it's like, case closed, right? Like if I were God, at every single debate ever held on any college campus about atheism and all that stuff, I'd just be like, what now, right? Like I'd just show up on the stage. And yet, what the scriptures say is extraordinarily, in many ways, God yearns for nothing more than to do that. And yet it is entirely an issue with us. Till we have faces, we are not able to encounter God. And so the promise here is not something that God is finally comes out from behind the bush he's hiding behind for those who are pure in heart. It's that purity of heart is the necessary precondition for us of sight of God. Which, if everything that we've been saying is true, is a promise that, yes, will ultimately be fulfilled on that day when Christ returns and makes all things new. But if it's a kingdom reality, it does mean that it's something that we can glimpse and receive foretaste of now. Right? This is that God awareness, some theologians call it, that manifestation of the presence of God. That I hope that if you've been following Jesus for any amount of time, you've had experiences of, where you go, whoa, God is in this place. Or God is speaking to me right now. Or I can actually sense his comfort. Or I can actually sense his conviction over me. Right? I love that the scriptures are honest about these. Paul, the apostle, who as best we can tell kind of got the closest thing ever to a face-to-face encounter with God on this side of the cross. Even he, in 1 Corinthians 13:12, says, "For now we see in a mirror dimly, but then face to face. Now I know in part, then I shall know fully," check this out, "even as I have been fully known." Do you see how he's saying, I see through a glass dimly. I know God in part, and yet I am fully known. I am fully seen by God. In other words, I am the one who lacks something in order to encounter God in that fullness. But I love Paul saying, but still there's, right, still he longs for that, that he would know God, even if it's just in part, that there would be a greater awareness of him in his life, a greater manifestation, that he would know those moments of conviction, of encouragement, of courage, with greater frequency. And Paul says, and yet, the reality, and I like a realist, right? We're New Jersey people. The reality is that there is a sense in which that will always be dim, that will always feel just out of reach to what our souls actually long for. Yet he says, and it's yet so worth pursuing with everything we have, even just in part, even through a glass dimly, that we would know God like that. And so he says, what I'm calling you to is a means, is a way to actually increase that reality in your life. He's setting us that vision. He's saying, I want you to start on a path that ends with something that your soul has always longed to know, which is better than defeat on a field of competition, right? It's actually something that your soul, that every soul in this universe longs for, that it might know God, that it might see God, even if only now in part. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall experience that. On that day, ultimately, but ever increasingly, even if dimly, our hearts will reconnect to the thing for which it was made. So what does it mean to be pure in heart? This is actually very interesting. As usual, and this becomes more clear as you go through the Beatitudes to the depth that we're doing them. Jesus is really pulling things, almost certainly from the Old Testament. A lot of times, interestingly, from two places. Normally from the Psalms and from the prophet Isaiah. In this case, from the Psalms, and it's what was read during the liturgy. Let me just read part of Psalm 24 again. Psalmist says, "Who shall ascend the hill of the Lord, and who shall stand in his holy place?" What's he talking about there? Where's this person going? Heaven, we might think of it as heaven. That's actually an interesting answer. Yeah, the temple. Good, right? The temple, a sense of where heaven meets earth, where God's, literally the temple is called God's footstool. It's like where God is physically manifest, right? God's space is heaven. Our space is here on earth. The temple is where those two things overlap. So who can go there? Who can experience God in that place? The psalmist says, "He who has clean hands and a pure heart." There it is, a pure heart. "Who does not lift up his soul to what is false and does not swear deceitfully. He will receive blessing from the Lord," there's our word, "and righteousness from the God of his salvation. Such is the generation of those who seek him, who seek the face of the God of Jacob." New Testament. James chapter 4. Go to that next slide for me, Luke. Submit yourselves, therefore, to God. Resist the devil, and he will flee from you. Draw near to God, and he will draw near to you. Cleanse your hands, you sinners, and purify your hearts. Pure hearts. You double-minded. Picking up on this idea. So both in Psalm 24, in James, who's the brother of Jesus, who much of the letter of James, who's an early church leader, much of the letter of James is clearly picking up on the teaching of the Beatitudes and sort of fleshing them out. It's a very interesting study to do, to look at James and then to look at the Beatitudes. And so he's picking up on this idea of purity of heart. And notice a couple things. First, he says that purity of heart involves a kind of submission to God rather than to other things. Same as Psalm 24. Blessed are those who have clean hands and a pure heart and don't lift themselves up. It's sort of another way of talking about lifting yourself up, bowing yourself down, submitting to that which is false, that which is not God, to things other than God. So in both cases, we have this idea that purity of heart. Here's what I'm getting at. I think we hear purity of heart and we hear moral perfection. Okay, clearly we do. Strong confirmation, right? We think purity of heart, and we think those who don't sin, those who don't have lustful, greedy thoughts, those who don't think bad of other people, those whose sin record is clean, like this is exclusively for them. And if that's the case, we should just jump, boop, Beatitudes, right? And be like, okay, not for me. Because none of us would qualify for that. What's interesting is that actually in every place where purity of heart is talked about, there's this language of purity of heart submits first and foremost to God, and in some ways only to God, at the expense of not lifting yourself up to another. Purity of heart submits to God with ultimate allegiance, therefore denying other things, other pursuits, its allegiance. Purity of heart is not what James calls, what Jesus' brother calls, double-mindedness. Put in the words of Jesus elsewhere in the Sermon on the Mount, you can't serve two masters. For either he will hate the one and love the other, or he will be devoted to the one and despise the other. In that case, he's talking about God and money. A good place to start, right? Like, if you really, really want to be wealthy and will do what it takes, no matter what, to be wealthy, you're going to make some choices that suggest that you are not ultimately submitted to God, that your allegiance is not to God, that your allegiance is actually to that pursuit. So the word that kept coming to mind for me this week as I thought about what does it mean to be pure in heart, the word that kept coming to mind is uncompromised. You know, compromises, yes. Like, I'm a Christian, but I also, like, really like this thing over here. Maybe it's not the best thing, right? It's cops saying, I'll do one job because I need the money, and it'll be a one-time thing. No one will get hurt. And then 2 years later, he goes, I can't sleep, I can't eat, I don't know how you do this. And the guy says, the only way to do it is to find ways to rationalize it. Right? Little compromises become life-altering rationalizations. And Jesus is saying, those life-altering rationalizations can blur your experience of God, keep you from seeing and experiencing God, can harden your heart and fog your vision of God. You ever been there? This is one where you're like, when I really think about it, it's like, oh, I know what that's like. I know what that's like. To be rationalizing so much that you squirm a little more in church, right? That you kind of feel like, do I have to go, right? You stop going to Bible study on campus. You stop going to large group, right? You stop showing up at discipleship course because you're just like, I hope this thing that I'm rationalizing in my life doesn't come up because I'm just not ready to lay it down. I read someone who said this week, before before we ever give ourselves to sin, we've said yes to an alternate story about what will satisfy or fulfill us. Isn't that really good? Or awful? Yeah. Insightful, I guess is what I mean. This is looking at our lives and taking really seriously. Where am I fragmented? Where is my heart beginning to be given to a little bit of this over here and a little bit of this over here? And yes, maybe still Jesus, but it's not the whole thing. I'll never forget. Part of my story is grew up in a wonderful Christian home, grew up all around faith, went to college, did the boneheaded, I'm going to figure things out on my own thing, which very quickly led me to a life and a lifestyle that I was very confused in. Then I walked into a campus ministry, and the guy was talking about living an integrated life. And he said, some of you have deposited yourselves in so many buckets of identity. You're like this over here, and you're like this over here, and you're like this over here, and you're like this over here, that sometimes you just forget which one you're supposed to be. And what Jesus offers is one bucket in the middle that all of it can be poured in. You can live out of a kind of oneness in him. And I went, that's what I need. That's what my soul feels, is like, I don't even know who I am anymore. Like, the way that I've put it is like things were being etched on my character. I was like, I don't aspire to this, but I don't know how else to be when I'm submitted to this other thing and other pursuit in my life. And oh, the idea of oneness was so attractive to me. And that really began my journey in many ways back to faith or to a much deeper sort of life-committed kind of faith. And that's what Jesus is talking about here. This guy named Thomas Cranmer, you know Thomas Cranmer, he was part of the Reformation. There you go. That's about all I know. 500 years ago. I mean, this is written 2,000 years ago, and it's unbelievably perceptive. But 500 years ago, he sums up all of his theology by saying, what the heart wants, the will chooses, and the mind justifies. What the heart wants, the will chooses, and the mind justifies. You see, we think, especially as post-Enlightenment people, what we believe is the most important thing about us. Well, if I believe it, it's just going to be true in my life. And then some of us are like, boy, this faith thing, like, I believe it. Like, I check off all the marks. Yep, Jesus was the Son of God. Jesus died for my sin. Like, I could check off all the marks. But, man, I'm still struggling with certain things in my life. And Jesus is saying, yeah, that's because actually life flows from the heart, from what you love, from what you're choosing. I think probably the best way, I was just with the discipleship course, the 101 discipleship course, and they were finishing up spiritual discipleship, those of you who have done it. One of the things we talk about in that at the end is so much of what Jesus is getting at is what we give our attention to draws out our affections, draws out our desires, right? Right now we live in an attention economy. You know that? That's how people talk about what we're doing? That's why your doom scrolling gets more and more weirdly accurate, right? Within a moment, it gets more accurate, right? Where you're like, whoa, okay, I guess today I'm interested in, you know, stacks of people to be read books. I remember the other day, I was like, now everything on my thing is like to be read because I was looking at one person, what they're reading in October, right? Like the quickness with which, because it's trying to pull us, not necessarily into that content, it's just trying to keep us there. And as it keeps us there, it both is responding to, ooh, I like that. Ooh, I wait a little bit longer on that. Let me, right? And sometimes that's horribly, you know, wicked, awful stuff, but sometimes it's super benign stuff. But man, you look at a new faucet, you're gonna get a lot of faucets. You know what I mean? It's both reflecting back to you what your heart wants and then telling you, you really want this one. You really want what? If you want a faucet, have you thought about a new sink? And you're like, sinks are a thing? I could have a bigger sink. I could have a sink with two. Well, that's amazing, right? And it's both reflecting back to you your heart, but it's also doing things to your heart. Then Jesus comes in and he says, abide in me. Abide in me. Abide in me. ancient word that never would have been used in a religious context. It's just a word that means hang out with us. Literally at the end of the story of Jacob's well, where the woman, her life is forever changed, she runs into the city, she's like, come see a man who told me that I ever did. The town comes out, and guess what they asked Jesus to do? Abide with us, hang out with us, stay with us. Like grab a hotel, grab an Airbnb, like just stay. Jesus goes, that's what so much of the Christian life comes down to. Abide with me, abide with me, abide. Give me your attention. Give me your attention. Let me and my word be the thing that reflects back to you where your heart is at, and then to develop your heart. Why give that over to an algorithm? Give that over to me. Let me be the one who sets your heart where it belongs and to be that mirror to what's actually going on in your life, because I'm the only one who isn't going to stoke the bad stuff. You see, because right now we live in a cultural moment that says all of your lack of freedom is an external reality. And if we could just free you up from the bounds of culture, you could actually fully express your desires, and that would be life to the full. Jesus says, that would be to your disaster. Because it's actually those desires. You don't want to sink that much, right? Like, you don't actually want to keep doing this. And so he says, I'm the one who actually names the desires that are actually warring with your heart. In fact, Jesus uses pretty strong language. New Testament uses pretty strong language. Right, like I'm thinking of stuff that we did in our course just a couple weeks ago, where the Apostle Paul is responding to the people in Corinth who are like, yeah, but we're free in Christ. He's like, you are free in Christ, but you should not be dominated by anything. Why would you willingly choose to be enslaved by a desire that is not actually going to lead to your flourishing? So yeah, you're free in Christ, but you still got to be careful with your attention, because there's kinds of desires that will destroy you and kinds of desires that will free you. And the one who made you and knows your heart, the one who your soul longs to see, is the one whose definition of those things is the one that you should trust, not the algorithm. I'm adding words to Jesus, I don't think. He talked about that, right? But that's what he's saying. That's what purity in heart is. Soren Kierkegaard, a great philosopher last century, very famous, probably the most famous thing that he ever said, I thought of it all week, is purity of heart is to will one thing. Namely, to be in step with the will of God. So how do we do this? How do we pursue purity of heart? I want to keep it really simple. I think for all of us, this begins with a simple evaluation of what are the things in my life that I need to turn from, and what are the things that I need to turn toward, right? Can you put up that slide in case you didn't catch that? Next one. Next slide. There you go. Turn from, turn toward. What are the things in my life, right? And only, this is where I'm going to lean in to the Holy Spirit of God that does this way better than I could with a bunch of words, is where are those places in your life where you are compromised, where you say, yeah, but it's just a little bit of this. And look, social media and doom scrolling and all that is a very easy target. And for some of you, you at least need to start there. For others of you, maybe that's not even remotely an issue, or maybe it's one that you've tried for so long, move to something else, you know, like try something. But what do you need to turn from? Maybe it's an excessive obsession with something about your life, an excessive obsession that is compromising you, that is causing the allegiance of your heart to be drawn toward it in ways that actually cause you to make decisions that are against what God would call you to. A good way to identify these areas of compromise is, what am I rationalizing? What if someone were called out in me, I've maybe already pre-rehearsed how I would rationalize this? Probably a really good indicator. And keep in mind, this isn't because we want to be good little boys and girls. This isn't because I want to stand up here and guilt you. It's because, guys, the reward is sight of God. It's actually being able to perceive God. This verse, to me, I always think of because John Piper, great pastor in Minneapolis, and many of us love his stuff, but he talks about these things called fighter verses, where you just tuck these things away in your heart as a fight against something in your life, whether that's discouragement or doubt or whatever. In this one, he talks about as a fighter verse against lust, particularly. And I talked to countless students about this, is there's a lot of ways to try and fight that battle in your life. I don't think there's a better one than saying, my little victories in this area give me just a little bit more sight and perception of God. And if you fought that fight, you know the opposite of it. When you fall in that way, so often the thing, the hardest thing, and I'm talking to followers of Jesus here, the hardest thing in that area is all of a sudden God just feels distant. And God feels like, man, that's the last thing that I can think about right now. And I'm going to have to do the work to do my penance in order to re-receive the great blessing of God's presence. Now look, here's the beautiful truth, is all of that lack of perception is our end. God never left. And yet, what a beautiful way to fight that fight to say, no, I want to see God. I could see this other stuff. I'd rather see God. I'd rather perceive God. I'd rather know him a little bit more in my life. And that might not be your struggle, but whatever it is, whatever compromise, man, what a thing to speak to our hearts, to say the one who came and died and gave all for us, who died, right? Why did Jesus die? He died to take upon himself the sin that fogs our vision of him. It was worth his life because he knows how much we need it. And what a beautiful way to respond, to be uncompromised by holding this vision of, I want to see God today. I want a little bit more of God. And so why don't you just take 2 minutes before you come to this table and allow the Spirit to vulnerably search you and to ask the question, where am I compromised? Where am I rationalizing in life? And what might I turn from in order to turn more towards the things that help me perceive God? And I'll just say a word about turn toward, right? The idea there is, what helps you see God? Is it worship music? Is it the scriptures? Is it time with other brothers and sisters? Whatever it is, right? There's a turning from and a turning toward. And the amazing gift, the amazing promise is greater perception of God. So the band will come forward, and then I'll lead us into communion in just a minute. But why don't you just take those 2 minutes to ask that question before the Lord? Night before he was crucified, Jesus took bread at the table and he broke it and he said, this is my body broken for you. Take it in memory of what I have done for you and in anticipation of that day when we will see one another face to face. He then took wine that was at the table and he said, this is my blood poured out for the forgiveness, for the forgiveness, for the forgiveness of your sins. And God doesn't forgive us just to forgive us. He forgives us that we might be reconciled relationally to him. Again, that we might see him, even if just through a glass dimly, that our hearts might perceive him evermore. And so how we do communion here at Jacob's Well is we come down these two aisles. There's a gluten-free option in the middle. Bread on the outsides, wine and juice are labeled at all the tables. You take the bread, you dip it, and you can go out the sides. If you haven't given your life to Jesus, we would invite you to do that today. To just bow the knee. Your words aren't as important as your heart. Just tell Jesus, I need what you offer. I need that salvation. My soul longs to see you. Whatever words are coming are fine for now, but come to this table maybe as a first act of faith and then tell us you've done that so we can give you a sense of what's next. If you're not there yet, scriptures are clear. You honor Christ most by just remaining in your seat. I'd invite you to remain in silence if that's helpful for a little bit. The table will be available the entire time that we're singing, but feel free to come forward when you're ready.